Business and Halacha here, number 3. So last time at the end, we discussed the Isser of Lo Sachmod and Lo Sasaved, the Torah's prohibition against coveting. To recall, Lo Sachmod means don't covet, don't be jealous of somebody else's things to the point that you take it from them or you force them to sell it to you. Lo Sasaved is even plotting or scheming to get somebody else's stuff. The Rambam writes that we see the extent to which there is danger in desiring other people's things from the story of Achab and Kerem Nevos. What's the story? So the Rambam writes as follows: Hataiva mevi lidei chimod, v'achimod mevi lidei gezel. Taiva, desiring things, wanting things, leads to chemda, and chemda leads to gezel. Shim lo rata bailam limkor, afal pisha hirba bedamim vihiftir bireyim, yavo lidei gezel. If a person really wants something, so they're going to get it. So first, perhaps they'll offer money, and then if their offers of money are refused, they'll eventually come to stealing. Vim amdu habalim befanav lahatzel mimonam, and let's say the owners refuse to let you steal from them, so then that could even lead to murder. And he says, look at the story of Achav and Nevos to see how this happened. What was the story? So the pasuk says, "Va'idaber Achav el Nevos leimor tinali es karmecha v'yelagan yerek." Achav saw the beautiful kerem, the beautiful vineyard of Nevos, and he says, "Please give it to me. I'll pay full price." Nevos says, "No, Chalila, I will never give up my estate, my family's possessions." So Achav came home at night and he was all upset, and his wife says, "What's the problem?" And he tells her the story, and she says, "Don't worry, I'll take care of it." And of course she hires false witnesses, and eventually Nevos is executed for a crime he didn't commit, and Achav got the property and the like. So we see something that started off as innocent as simply wanting this additional beautiful garden, and that ended up in murdering an innocent person. Now, of course, that doesn't mean every time a person will desire something that will lead to murder, but we see that it really can lead to very terrible consequences. No. You're saying the Pasuk in Shmuel, right? Interesting question. So first of all, there's actually a debate in the whether that which is stated in Parshas HaMelech are those things that are permitted, or is the Navi saying that this is what's going to happen because kings tend to abuse power. Even if we assume like the opinion that it's permitted, so that doesn't mean he could just take anything he wanted. So there's actually a debate between the Rambam and Tosos exactly what that mitzvah means. But the bottom line is basically that the king might be able to take things that are in the national interest, meaning to say something similar to eminent domain. If the king sees that there's a need to take your vineyard because he wishes to build a highway or some type of national infrastructure or the like, so then he may have that right. But he can't just take your garden to expand his garden, even if you pay for it. Okay. So, an interesting halacha is like this. The can one be in violation of the Isser of Lo Sachmod or Lo Sasaved if something is for sale? Let's say something's for sale in a store, and I see, wow, I wish I could buy that. Are you in violation of the Torah's prohibition against Lo Sachmod or Lo Sasaved? So you sound like you're saying no. That's correct. You're not. Because Lo Sachmod or Lo Sasaved are violated when I desire something belonging to somebody else that doesn't want to sell them. Anything that's for sale, obviously, the owner would be very happy to sell it for you. Now, you may not be able to afford to buy it, or you might not be interested in buying it for the price that he's offering, but you're not in violation of Lo Sachmod and Lo Sasaved. Now, of course, it's not necessarily isn't a reflection of proper midos, and a person shouldn't always be desiring things and the like. But in terms of the formal restriction of los achmod and los esaveh, that's when you desire something that belongs to somebody else and you forcibly take it, or you scheme, you plot in order to take it. In this case, where it's for sale, so then one wouldn't be in violation. Let's say I go ahead and my friend asks me to help him move. So I'm in his basement packing up his stuff. I see a beautiful vase. I say, would you sell me that vase? I think it's beautiful. So he says, no, this is I got it from my grandmother. I'm never going to sell it. Would it be a violation of los esaveh to ask him again, perhaps on my way out, you sure you don't want to sell that? What if I, so what do you think? So you think no. So, yeah. So the Tshuvos B'Tzel HaChachma, it's quoted in the Pesachei Choshen, says that's not los esaveh to ask a second time. To start being pushy and try to push him to sell something that he really doesn't want to sell, so then you are indeed in violation. But to ask a second time in a friendly way, that's okay. Now, sometimes, admittedly, it's hard to know where the line is drawn. You're not allowed to be pushy to try to buy something that somebody doesn't want to sell, but presumably asking a second time is still okay. Now, is it only the seller, the buyer, that's in violation, or even the seller? So, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, Rabbi Levine was the chair of the economics department here in YU. He was nifter a couple of years ago, and I was an economics major. So I was zocha to take some of his economics classes. So the truth is that I never took any of his business halacha classes, though I helped him write a couple of books on business ethics and halacha. He was a very big expert in these types of matters, and he was also a big tzaddik. As you'll see from some of the Pesachim, we'll mention throughout the series. So he said that yes, indeed, if you engage in high pressure sales, so that's also a violation of lo esaveh, because I desire their money. Just like if you don't want to sell something and I try to pressure you to sell it to me, that's usur. So too, if you don't want to buy something, I'm a pushy encyclopedia salesman, and I pressure you to buy something that you're not really interested in, or to buy a life insurance policy from me, or anything. So if I pressure someone to buy from me, which is of course something that's frequently done, that's the same type of violation as pressuring somebody to sell something to me. So he thought that both the buyer and the seller are in violation. Anytime you basically are pushing someone to buy or sell something that they don't really want to buy or sell, so then one is in violation. Yeah.
So can this apply in other non-monetary contexts?
Such as? But they're not giving any money, they're just getting their approval?
It's kind of getting their approval so that you can kind of, expand your, well, this person said that they want to do it too, so we can go ahead.
I don't know if one would be in formal violation of the halacha in that case, because the psukim seem to be talking about possessions, right? Just look at the Ten Commandments, they're talking about animals or houses or wives or the like, but at the same time, it's certainly, I think, against the spirit of the law. Anytime you try to pressure somebody to do something that they don't want to do, and especially in this case where you're pressuring them to do something that's in your interest, or at least you perceive that it's in your interest, and they might be reluctant because they don't see it as in their interest, or they don't see it as being honest, or the like. So certainly, I would think that's a violation of the spirit of the law, if not the letter of the law. Yes? I don't know. I'm not so sure. I don't think it's right to pressure people into giving to tzedakah. I know that I get these calls sometimes, and I think it's awful what they do. You know, do you like to give something? And if you start saying no, they say, well, maybe would you consider a $36 donation? And then if you say no to that, what about an $18 donation? Can I put you down for that? Things like that. I think that that's inappropriate on many levels. Among other things, certainly, you know, maybe they think I don't give enough tzedakah. Well, how do they know? And even if I give enough tzedakah, you know, maybe I prioritize other causes. So I think it's very bad to do that. Would it be a technical violation? Again, I don't know, because hopefully the money isn't going to them. But the truth of the matter is the money is, in a sense, going to them, because these are professionals, and for all I know, they get a cut. They get a commission, in which case I think surely it would be a violation. So I don't think it's right. Yes? Usually not. Yeah, no. Usually in the same case, you don't have both. Yeah, exactly.
Is that true for services also?
I would assume. Again, I'm not sure if that would be a technical violation, but certainly against the spirit of the law. No. Advertising, when done properly, should not pressure anybody to do anything that they don't want to do. The idea of advertising, when done properly, is to try to show the great advantages of your product, or perhaps to convince a person that they might need your product. And we'll talk more about advertising when we get into the halachos of Bnei Vasdas, what type of advertising is okay and what type of is incorrect. But certainly, a salesman showing the advantages of their product or advertising those advantages, there's nothing wrong with that. Okay, we don't want you to get the impression from all this that commerce is a bad thing, or business is a bad thing. Okay, we're not going to turn to the next topic, which is the halachos of ona'a. So for this, why don't we look at the psukim? Vayikra Perek Chaf Hei, Pasuk Yadalad. There's not enough chumashim to go around. You could get some more from the back. Chaf Hei Yud Dalad. So it's next week's Parsha. We are almost on time. Parsha's Behar. V'chi timkeru mimkar la'amisecha, o kano miyad amisecha. When you sell something to your fellow or buy something from your fellow, al tonu ish es amito. So what does that mean? Al tonu ish es achiv. What does that mean? Al tonu ish es achiv. I gave you the chumashim without translation. You have translation. What does it mean? Al tonu ish es achiv. Do not aggrieve one another. What does aggrieve mean? I guess like aggravate. Do not aggravate one another. So if you translate this literally, I think that's a fine translation. Literally, it's not at all clear what in the world this is referring to, that you shouldn't aggrieve each other. But the continuation of the psukim make it clear what we actually mean. The psukim continue. Bimispar hashanim achara yovel tikne me'es amisacha. According to the number of years after yovel, you shall buy from your friend. Bimispar shnei svuos hu imkar lach. According to the number of crops, he is selling to you. Lefi rov hashanim tarbem miknaso, ulefi me'ot hashanim tamit miknaso. Kimispar tvuos hu mocher lach. So what this means is as follows. In the times when Yovel was observed, so when Yovel would arrive, the field that was sold would return to its original owners. So that means that the price should depend upon how many years there is till Yovel. If it's 36 years till Yovel, the field will be twice as expensive as if they're 18 years to Yovel. Maybe a little less for compounding, but that's the idea. So the Psukim are telling us that you should sell things based off of what they're worth. And that's why the idea of ona'a means overcharging. This is the prohibition in the Torah against overcharging. You may not rip someone off. You may not charge someone more than something is worth. We'll get into the details in a minute, but let's read the next pasuk. V'lo sonu ish es amiso, v'yareisa me'elokecha ani Hashem elokechem. What does this mean? V'lo sonu ish es amiso. So we already translated sonu as aggrieve. So you may not aggrieve your friend, and you shall fear God. So what is this referring to? So Chazal tell us that the first answer of onah that's mentioned is what we call onas mamon. Basically means to rip him off, to overcharge. That's onas mamon. The second onah can't be, and that's clear from the context that we're talking about buying or selling. The pasuk says v'chi timkiru, if you buy, or actually if you sell, sorry, right? So the first type of onah is about buying and selling. The second type of onah is what we call onas dvarim, onah of words. What does onah of words mean? What is the prohibition of onas dvarim? So again, we'll define this in just a couple of minutes. But onas dvarim is saying hurtful things or doing things, saying things that's going to cause pain to another person. So here we have two prohibitions. It's quite fascinating because the same word is used for both. The first is overcharging, onas mamon. The second is onas dvarim, dvarim as in words, saying things or doing things that's going to hurt a person's feelings, that's going to cause them pain. So let's define these two prohibitions. So the first is overcharging. So what's an example of overcharging? Think of an example in the real world where you've seen overcharging. Kifud. Okay. Okay, so we'll have to figure out this kifud overcharge. Why? What's your basis for their overcharging at kifud? I understand it seems like a lot of money, but how did you come to the conclusion that they're overcharging? Okay, so what's a store that sells a similar product that charges less? I'm sorry? Bravos. Bravos is down the block. So, you're saying... I didn't know that. Maybe I should shop at Bravo's. Okay, so you're saying that Kifud and Bravo's, or Associated, are the same type of store, right? That's you correctly noted that we're not necessarily going to compare different types of stores or different locations. So it wouldn't be fair to compare Kifud, let's say, to ShopRite in Englewood. Maybe ShopRite's cheaper, but they're not the same type of store. Kifud is located in the city. ShopRite in the suburbs. They're both supermarkets, but they're different types. Okay, and we're also not going to compare it to the kosher mini market over here. It's also a different type of store. But you're saying that Kifud should be compared to, at least with the regular products, not their specialty kosher products, with Bravo's. And Kifud is, and what was the other one? Associated. Okay, and let's say all other medium-sized supermarkets in Washington Heights, and Kifud charges more than them, and that would be a violation of onah. Okay, quite possibly. So that's a good example of onah. We'll get into the details more and see if that meets criteria, but at first glance, it seems to be a good example. So that's onah. Now, as the pasuk makes clear, onah could be violated by both the buyer and the seller. In this case, you're saying onah is being violated by the seller. Kifud, by charging so much, is in violation of onah. What would an example of onah by a buyer be? Yeah?
Someone who's willing to pay an outrageous price way beyond the typical market value.
Okay, but then who's in violation? If I go ahead, you're selling a chumash. The chumash market value is $20. I say, I give you $50 for the chumash. So who violated the yeser? I violated the yisr? Oh, you violated the yisr. You violated the yisr by taking that money.
Well, why is anyone in violation in that case?
Okay.
But isn't that a fact? Like, it's everyone else.
Okay, good. So let's give, let's, good.
If you say you're only paying $10, that $20 for that $20 comment.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. So that's a better example. More straightforward example. So you're selling a chumash, and I say, I'll pay you $10 for it when the chumash is worth $20, right? So now, that's correct. Let's give a more straightforward example, and then we'll extrapolate. Let's imagine I have making a yard sale, and or my mother's making a yard sale. She wanted to move, and she's moving from Silver Spring to New York. She's got to get rid of all the stuff in her house because there's no room in the apartment for all that stuff. So she makes a yard sale, and among the things she's selling is all the things in my room. So the baseball card collection. Ah, so now she doesn't know what everything's worth. So she sees this. She says, 5 cents a card, big box of cards, or $1 a card for the ones in the plastic things. So somebody goes, wow, this Cal Ripken Jr. rookie card, this is probably worth $50, but it's only marked $1. So he goes ahead and he pays $1 to my mother. My mother says, thank you so much. Here you go. It's only a piece of cardboard anyway. I'm so happy I got $1 for a piece of cardboard. And this guy goes away thinking, wow, I got a $50 base violation of Ona. The buyer, correct. And that's correct. Now, and the answer is that Ona is violated either by the buyer or the seller any time the price is different. We'll define how different it is. Anytime the price is different from the market price. The market price for Cal Ripken Jr. rookie is $50, let's say. So if you sell it for $1, that's true. Now, it happens to be the case that if the buyer and the seller both know the value, and in this case the seller is willing to be mochel, this guy goes to my mother and says, you know, this card's worth $50. Look, here's the Beckett's guidebook. It says $50. And my mother says, still, I'm selling all things for $1. Everything must go. So then there's no violation. She's mocheles. Usually, almost always, when it comes to Ona is a result of a disequilibrium of knowledge. Either the buyer knows something that the seller doesn't know. In this case, the buyer knows that this baseball card's worth $50. The seller is unaware of its true value. Or the opposite. The seller is aware of the value, and the buyer isn't aware of the value. Let's say you're a cab driver, and you pick up this guy from the airport, and he says, I want you to take me to the Ritz-Carlton. And you say, wow, this guy, he's loaded, and he doesn't know what a cab ride's supposed to cost. He barely speaks English. I'm going to charge him $250 for a cab ride from JFK to Manhattan when there's a market rate. It's a flat fee of $45, $65, whatever it is. So now I've charged him way above the market rate. So in that case as well, there's a disequilibrium of knowledge. In that case, the seller is over on Ona. You could have Ona not just for good, but for service as well. Sometimes it's possible that both the buyer and the seller will be unaware of something's value, in which case they would be in violation. Now, it might be by accident. For example, I might have the yard sale, and I sell this chair for $200, a nice old wooden chair. I'm not aware that this is a Louis XIV chair worth $100,000. And the buyer isn't aware either. So in that case, that was Ona. We'll see in a moment that Ona, that's above a sixth, the halacha is there's bittul mekach, the sale is undone. So if I discover that information, I could go to the buyer and say, look, give me my chair back, I'm going to give you your $250 back. I could be mevatel the mekach. In that case, nobody did anything wrong intentionally, because both the buyer and the seller was unaware of its true value. But if both the buyer and the seller are aware, let's say in yard sales, so in yard sales and estate sales, it's very typical that things are sold way below their typical value, because that's the idea. The idea of a yard sale is you just want to get of everything. And if you sold things at market rate, 1% of your products would go, and you're trying to clear out. So there are lots of things that you might not know the exact value, but you are aware that it's very possible that you're selling well below value. not something worth $200,000 for $250, but might be worth $50, $60 and you're selling it for $10, and then the buyer and the seller are both aware, then it's fine. You could be mochel. But if the buyer or the seller is not mochel, and one of them or even both of them are unaware of its market value, and it's sold or bought for significantly different than the market value, so then that would be a violation of onah. So we'll get to the details here. There are lots and lots of practical, detailed questions. But before I get to them, I'd like to just think about for a moment, since we started off with the psukim, an interesting question, which is what do the psukim have to do with each other? What is there a connection between onas mamon and onas dvarim? Again, onas mamon is overcharging or undercharging, and onas dvarim is saying things or doing things that cause hurt to another person. The lashon of the Tosefta and Bava Metzia is very interesting. Kishem she'onah b'mekach u'memkar, just as there is onah in commerce, kach onah b'dvarim, so too there is onah with words. Ve'od mirube onah s'dvarim me'onas mamon. And moreover, onah s'dvarim is worse than onah karka. Sorry, than onah mamon. She'be'onah achiv hu omer v'lo tonu ish es achiv. When it comes to onas mamon, it says, "Do not do onah. Do not. What did you say it was called again? Don't grieve your friend, meaning overcharge. Uvo nas dvarim hu omer lo sonu ish es amito v'aresa melokecha me." The yaresa mimi shepiked al elu, or piked o. Can't read it exactly. So what's the idea? The fact is that the pasuk says after onas dvarim, the yaresa melokacha, implying that it's worse. So first of all, it's very interesting. The Tosefta implies that there's a connection between these two isurim. You see that in the juxtaposition in the psukim, the fact that the same word is used for both. And the lashon of the Tosefta highlights that kashem, that there's onah in commerce, so too there's onah bedvarim. And it's even worse. So, first of all, what's the connection? And second of all, why is it worse? Any thoughts? Why is it worse? We'll start off with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great answer. Great answer when it comes to dine mamonos. So, the fix it is much easier. I pay back the money that was overcharged, or we are mevatel the transaction. When it comes to onas dvarim, so the phrase "sticks and stones will break my bones, but never names will never hurt me" isn't true. And if somebody is hurt or offended or the like, that's something that's not very easy to repair. And even saying "I'm sorry" does not always undo the damage that has been caused. And therefore, onas dvarim is worse. I think we might add that onas mamon doesn't relate to the person. What have you harmed? You haven't harmed them. You've harmed their assets, their money. When you hurt a person's feeling, you've in a sense caused them much more harm, because it's who they are. And that perhaps might relate to the answer of how these two things are related. In the opening shiur on this series, we noted how a lot of times the Torah's definition of a concept that exists in monetary law is different than the secular definition. And perhaps one example is gazel. The Torah considers onah a form of gazel. We'll see the implications of that shortly. And that's a chiddush, because we usually think of gazel as, I take something from you. This is not gazel. Okay, maybe somebody would say it's not so nice to take advantage of a customer who's not really aware of something's true value. But half of commerce is all about trying to get those customers that don't quite know what something is really worth, or selling them some type of investment product that might not be quite what it's supposed to be, or the like. So much of onah, so much of commerce is about onah. And one could argue, that's not stealing. both parties agree to go into this transaction. And we might even add that they agree, and they're aware that there's a possibility that they're going to get ripped off. After all, people know that not everything is being sold at the fair market value, and they still decide to engage in commerce. And perhaps there's even a big sign over the marketplace that says, buyer beware. So it's your problem. And you might say, listen, what's wrong with what I did? He should have done more research. He could have looked up in the Beckett's Guide online, how much is this worth, and found out that really I'm ripping him off. And if he's too lazy to do his research, what's wrong with my overcharging and taking advantage? One could make all those arguments that it would be okay, and certainly that it wouldn't be a form of gazelle. But in fact, the Torah not only prohibits this, but it considers it gazelle. And there are many aspects of gazelle that aren't necessarily intuitive. The truth is, the Gemara at the beginning of Ezu Neshach says even ribis, interest, is a form of gazelle, which is extremely surprising. Both parties are going into the agreement with full disclosure and awareness, and you're even compensating the person for the lost opportunity cost of his money. Gnevas das, false goodwill, is a form of gneva. According to the Ritva, it's a form of gneva. You're in Torah violation of the Isser of gneva. What is gnevas das, false goodwill? I go ahead and I do something that leaves you with the impression that I did you a favor that in fact I didn't do. The Gemara gives an example. I go ahead and I want you to think I'm a really generous person. So I know you're going away for Shabbos. You're not going to be in the Heights of Shabbos. Oh, you want to come over for Shabbos. So that's gnevas das. Why? Because you think I did you a favor that I didn't do. Gnevas das. But what? I didn't take anything from you. No, that is a false goodwill. So we'll see many examples. We'll define the parameters of gnevas das, God willing, maybe next week. But what you see is that the Torah's definition of gneva is perhaps very, very different than what we would intuitively think. To put it a little differently, there's not always a fine distinction between yoredeya and choshen mishpat. Choshen mishpat is monetary laws. Yoredeya is iser v'heter, things like the laws of kashrus or the laws of nida. What's mutter, what's aser? So if I asked you, what section of Shulchan Aruch do you think ribis is found in? What would you guess? Choshen Mishpat. That's what I would have guessed also. But where is it? Yoredeya, correct. I once, when I was in 12th grade, one of the Rebbeim of Nachum from Shalvim came to my yeshiva to give bechinas. And I wasn't actually considering Shalvim, but somebody told me I should go speak to him anyway. I hope it wasn't Nevas Das. I think I told him in advance that I wasn't interested in his yeshiva. Anyway, we ended up talking. His question was, what chelak of Shulchan Aruch is Hilchos Ribis in? And talking about it for 2 hours. That was the whole bechina. Only one question. I was very happy because it got me out of English class most of the afternoon. But anyhow, the truth is, there's actually a technical answer if you look in the Torah to why Hilchos Ribis is in Yoredeya, not in Choshen Mishpat. But perhaps more fundamentally as well, it highlights the point that we're getting at, which is that there isn't a clear line of demarcation. And many things that we would not have imagined as being included in Gazelle are in fact, according to the Torah, prohibited as a form of Gazelle. We might have thought intuitively that's not so nice, but gazelle. And perhaps the idea is as follows. When I go ahead and I do gneva stas, assuming for a moment that it's a form of gneva, so in what way is it gneva? I didn't take his money, so you could say, well, he feels like he owes me something, and in that sense, it's gneva. That's certainly part of the answer. But perhaps part of the answer as well is that All of these halachos are rooted in the fact that every human being is a tzelem Elokim. That's their essence. And to take from them their money, or to take from them something else, genevas das, to, as it were, steal their das, are both prohibited, and perhaps equally prohibited. In fact, like we said, genevas das, onas dvarim, is even worse. What I've taken from them is even worse than taking their money, because their money isn't them. But in genevas das, in onas dvarim, what I've taken from them is even more basic, because of who they are. And perhaps that's how these are related. Okay, so now let's turn to some of the details of onah. So number one, we said that it's all both the buyer and the seller are in violation. Number two, or could be in violation. Number two, we said that one is only in violation if there's some type of a disequilibrium of knowledge, or at least one or both of the parties is unaware of the true value. If both parties are aware of the true value, but they nevertheless choose to pay more, so then that's not necessarily going to be onah. So if we go back to your kifud example, is that onah? So I would think it still could be onah. Even if I'm aware, generally speaking, that many products in kifud are, let's say, above market value. Now, this might go on the internet, so I want to state that I don't actually know that this is true. I'm simply using your example. We don't want to be motzi laz on kifud. Without kifud, where would we get our Pesach products with those sticker, post-Pesach products with the stickers, and our potato kugel and the like? But let's assume that your assertion is correct. So I don't think, even if I have some vague awareness that there are lots of things that are overpriced in kifud, that won't necessarily solve the problem. Perhaps only some of the products are. Perhaps one-third of the products are above market value, so then it might still be onah. Now, a very difficult question for onah is going to be determining market value, and that's sometimes quite difficult in the modern economy when it comes to groceries. So, as we pointed out, there are all sorts of different types of stores that naturally have different types of prices. So a mini market is in a different type of market than a supermarket, just like Marshall's and Bloomingdale's are in different markets. So even if Bloomingdale's charges the same amount, twice as much for Hanes undershirts, the very same shirts, as Marshall's does, that's not necessarily onah. Why? They're really different markets. They're, one is a shop that has a lot of ambiance. I'm not sure why exactly somebody would pay twice as much for that, but all sorts of services, everything is where you'd expect it. There's help from the sales department, and another, everything is in just a big mess and you can never find what you want and you have to wait in long lines and who knows what. So okay, so those are different markets, but again, let's assume that your assertion is correct, that all the other similar supermarkets in the same neighborhood charge less for all products. So then kifud would definitely be in violation of onah, it would seem. Again, assuming that there's an unawareness, which I think usually there would be, especially because not all the products are overpriced. Usually, in these types of stores, you're not going to get away with onah for too long, because people will just stop shopping in your store. And you'll say, well, there's no other store in the neighborhood, so then the other stores might be considered a different market. But apparently, kifud stays in business. Anyway, okay. It's also true, by the way, that the post can point out that when we talk about market price, it doesn't have to be a specific set price. It could be that the market price is a range. It could be that, for example, bananas go for anywhere from 49 cents a pound to 79 cents a pound. So therefore, yeah, somebody charged 99 cents a pound, won't mention any names, so that would be onah. right? Because all the other stores in a similar market, there's a range. Some are 49 cents a pound, some are 59 cents a pound, some are 69 cents a pound. All the other stores are between 49 and 79. So yeah, indeed, perhaps 99 cents could be a violation of Ona. Yes? So if it's the case that the market for Pesach or around Pesach changes, so then perhaps it wouldn't be Ona. Meaning to say, it's obvious that if you charge more for blueberries in the winter than you do in the summer, that's no problem. Because even if it's the same product, the market's changed. It's really not the same product. In the winter they're from Chile, and in the summer they're from Maine. But if basically the market price for the same good, let's even assume, changes around Pesach time, so that's not necessarily Ona, because you're not charging above market price. But if everybody, you see, a lot of times people get all upset, they say, that's Ona. A lot of the times that we intuitively feel like this store is doing Ona, it's not necessarily Ona. They might be have a monopoly, right? They might be the only store in the neighborhood, the only kosher store in the neighborhood. So you might not think it's nice that they charge so much. Maybe it isn't nice, but it's not Ona in a sense if you have a monopoly, because there's no market price that I could compare this product to. And the fact that in a different town they charge less doesn't necessarily mean it's Ona if we don't see that as the same market. Now, it's important to stress that when we talk about Ona, we're not talking about profit. We're talking about above market price. You could have a very high profit margin or a very low profit margin. Ona has nothing to do with the profit margin. I might go ahead and, you know, you have a middleman who buys wicker chairs from China for $8 a chair and sells them to retail stores for $20 a chair, who sell them to the public for $180 a chair, and all of those transactions were done without there being any Ona, even though the markups were humongous, because Ona relates to charging above the market rate. It does not relate to profit margins. The Gemara does say that with respect to certain staple goods, like staple food products, they imposed a 20% profit margin, like flour and oil. And for non-staple food goods, they imposed a 100% profit margin. And there were no laws stated with respect to non-food goods. Those halachos aren't Ona. That was a separate takana, a takana sashuk, a takana that Chazal made to make sure that staple food products were available and that vendors were not making a lot of profit and thereby making it difficult for people to buy. Those halachos only apply, at least Mikar Hadin, when all of the participants in the market would follow the halacha. Meaning to say, if there are three stores in a neighborhood and one or two of them don't have firm owners, so they wouldn't abide by this halacha, then I don't have to abide by it if I have a store. But if all the stores in the town are following the Shulchan Aruch, so then yes, there might be certain goods, staple goods, for example, about which there's a profit maximum. That's based off of Takana. But the Torah's violation of Ona, it relates to charging above market rate and has nothing to do with amount of profit. So a lot of times when you see stores that sell things for ridiculous amounts, you might feel like that isn't right, but it's not necessarily the case that it's Ona. Yes?
So I actually have an example from Israel where there was a tour being advertised, and I found out afterwards they charged a different price for Israelis than they were. Is that considered wrong?
That's an interesting question. So. So what do you, you spoke to them afterwards?
No, but I was upset. I was very upset. I knew they were probably overcharging, but what was I supposed to do?
Right, right. That's a good question. So, there's no. If you saw that the price being charged to Israelis was the market price, and then they charged Americans more, so that would certainly be ona. In this, right, you know, could you argue that there's no market price because this is a unique good? So that's an interesting question. I don't know. In other words, since there are two prices, it's not a market price in a typical sense, because let's assume that, like you said, they're the only ones offering the tour. It's not really a market for tours. As we noted, the laws of Onah don't guarantee that people won't make excessive profits. But if you saw it, here you're saying it's not so simple. The market was really for the Americans. But if Israeli wanted to come, so they let them come in for cheaper, you're saying.
You can charge Americans whatever you want because they're rich. That's basically
right. Right. That's an interesting question. Interesting question. You know, lots of stores do that. Not stores, like let's say airline tickets. So, you know, you'll have 100 people on the same flight and almost nobody paid the same price. So there it's being done, not even, you know, no human is involved in setting the standards perhaps, but does that make it or not? It's an interesting question. I don't know. I'll think about it. Blina Adar, I'll get back to you, hopefully by next week. But I'm not sure that would be Ona. Again, there's definitely times where perhaps it's wrong to have certain types of profit and things like that. That doesn't always mean it's going to be in a formal violation of Ona. Yes? I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Certainly, you know, if the market price is $100, so that's true. It doesn't really matter what you bought it for. Sometimes in these types of sales, I think there's type of gneivas das or other types of misleading stores that go ahead and double the price and then write 50% off, so that they are giving the impression that this is 50% off when it's actually really the whole price. So that could be problematic. We'll talk about that more when we get to gneivas das. But in your case, I don't think you're doing anything wrong. You're not required to disclose what you happen to pay for it. So what you're saying is true. The market price is $100. I'm selling it to you for $90. The fact that I happen to buy it on sale for $50 is irrelevant. There's no reason why I have to tell that to the seller. Okay, the Sefer HaChinuch writes, quoting the Gemara, Shelo honos echad miYisrael, ben zachar ben nekeva b'mekach u'memkar. The Isser is not to rip someone off in commerce, whether male or female. Notice how it says echad miYisrael. That's based off the pasuk that says okayno miyad amitecha. Many poskim rule that there's an iser ona to non-Jews as well. The only difference is, and when the Gemara makes a drasha amitecha to exclude non-Jews, that's with respect to bitul mekach and with respect to shtus and the like. But the iser applies both to Jew and non-Jew. And the lashon of the Gemara implies that a little bit. That's the view of the Zakan Aron. You could make a diuk like that from the from the Lashon of the Ramban. So there might be an Isser as well to non-Jews. Shenamar, l'chitim kirum yumkar l'amitecha, o kano miyad amitecha. If you thought that it was permissible, as I said, many poskim say it's Asser, the Rashash also. Those that would say it's permissible say that, and this is an important rule, we'll elaborate upon this a little bit later, but when is it that we find, generally speaking, distinctions in the halacha between Jew and non-Jew? And when is it that we don't? So what's an example that we find a distinction in monetary law? Ribbis, great, that's a good example. As we mentioned on several occasions, stealing is prohibited. So what's the difference, let's say, between ribbis and stealing? Why is one a case where we distinguish between Jew and non-Jew, and one a case where we don't distinguish? So the Ramban explains that you're going to say something? So, okay, that might be true, but it's really much more fundamental. Okay, that might be true as well, but that's still not going to be matirat. Even if lots of Jews charge interest to each other, it's still not going to be permitted. So the difference is, okay, dina machus dina, maybe, but let's say it's a country that prohibits ribbis, then it might be technically aser because of dina machusa, but let's say it's a country that permits stealing. So all of your distinctions might be correct, but there's really a much more fundamental distinction. If you look at the pasuk that distinguishes between the Nachri and the Yehudi with respect to interest, it says, Lo sashich l'achicha, neshech kesech, neshech ochal, l'nachri tashich l'achicha, lo tashich. The pasuk stresses that the difference is that a Jew is your brother. Meaning to say there's nothing fundamentally immoral about charging interest. We mentioned before, both parties are fully aware of what's going on. Everybody knows, this is the deal. I'm going to lend you $100 now, and at the end of the year, you're going to return $105. There's full awareness on both parties. Moreover, you're compensating. The borrower is compensating the lender for the lost opportunity cost of his money. If he didn't lend the money to you, so he could have used the money to buy something for himself, to invest it and perhaps earn a profit, and the like. You're compensating him for the lost opportunity cost. He might be making money in the process. You're allowed to make money. You're allowed to sell things as a profit. Like we said, you're allowed to rent things. So there's nothing fundamentally immoral about charging interest. So why is it wrong? Like the pasuk says, Lo sashich le'achicha. Do you charge interest to your brother or sister? No, that's not something that we would ever do. Because you would charge interest to a stranger doesn't mean you would charge interest to your brother. If your brother asks you for a loan, of course you would lend him money without interest if you have the money. So that being the case, that's where we find, the Ramban says, the distinction between Jew and non-Jew. If something's immoral, so then it's immoral and it can't be done even to a non-Jew. You're not allowed to act in an immoral way to a non-Jew. When it comes to something like interest, which is a reflection of our fraternity with Jews, that every Jew, we should see them as our brother. It's an act of chesed, an act of tzedakah. So when it comes to tzedakah, in fact, we do distinguish between Jew and non-Jew. Even if we happen to paskin that perhaps befarnesin aniyeh akum im aniyeh Yisrael, but certainly aniyach are kodmin. So that's why we find, that's where we find a distinction. So those, when it comes to onah, if we follow the Mahalach of the Ramban, those, if you argued that there's no Isser Onah for non-Jews, it would be because both parties are aware of what's going on. It's not fundamentally immoral. Those who argue, like I said, I think the Ramban himself implies this actually, those who argue that there is an Isser Onah to non-Jews would say no, that this is immoral. Whether we go as far in terms of the dinim of Hachzaras Ana or not, so there we don't go as far. But fundamentally, it's wrong even to a non-Jew because it's immoral. Yes? That's an interesting thing. So achiv generally does mean to exclude non-Jews. That's what we said. There's definitely a difference in hilchos onah between Jew and non-Jew. The debate in the poskim is, what is the difference? Is it mutter versus aser, or is it aser either way? It's just the question is, is there a difference, a distinction with respect to returning the money or not? Now, just one last point. So continuing in the Sefer Achinuch, V'amru zichronam levracha, al tonu isha sachiv zu onas mamonu vegemara amru zechmanim levracha miyad amitacha davar nikne miyad miyad kolomar mitatalin. The pasuk says in the prohibition against onam miyad, implying something that's transferred hand to hand, or mitatalin, movable goods, as opposed to real estate. So from that we have the halacha of ein onah bikarkos. There's no onah when it comes to real estate. So the Sefer HaChinuch goes on to explain, this is based off of the Ramban, that that doesn't mean that there's a heter to overcharge, let's say, for real estate. It just means that the regular rules of that if it's 1/6 difference, the money goes back. If it's more than 1/6, the transaction is negated. We'll talk about those halachos next week, HaBe'ezus Hashem. There we don't apply those rules to karka. And why would karka be different? So you might have said that's because karka doesn't have the same type of fixed market value as other things. When what's the market rate for a house? So you could give a range, right? 4-bedroom houses in this neighborhood go from $400,000 to $450,000, perhaps. But you can't say, oh, the market price is $429,000, $500,000. There's lots and lots of factors. Is it on a big street or on a smaller street? How old is the house? All sorts of even subjective factors. Some people like colors. And so you might have said that's the reason. Sefer HaChinuch gives a different reason, though they might be related. Ella ha'inyan hu lomar shedine ona kagon ha'chilukin she'amru zechronim levracha be'ona shehi chazaras biyosef mishtos v'dina b'fachos mishtos don't apply. Why? Shedas abriya shelolizbol ona yisera mikain b'metatl. The idea of 1/6 is that people don't tolerate ona of more than 1/6 when it comes to movable objects. Aval b'karka l'fisha karka davar kayim, because land is fixed, it stays forever, it doesn't depreciate or wear down. So then, derech habrios limchol bo, there's more flexibility in terms of price fluctuations with respect to what people are willing to tolerate. And therefore, the laws of onah are not as strict. Okay. Yes?
I'm just a little confused by this onah not applying to karka, because
it's a fascinating question. The psukim are talking about karka.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's a question dealt with in the Gemara and the Rishonim. The basic answer is, though this doesn't cover it entirely, is that the sale of land that the psukim are talking about is not really a sale. It's basically renting the land. When you sold land at the time that Yovel was Noheg, so like the pasuk says, Mispar Tvuos Hu Mocher Lach, he's not actually selling the land. If you sell your land and it's 26 years till Yovel, so really you're renting him the land for 26 years. So that would seem to be the case. Yeah. Okay. So we'll stop here. Be'ezras Hashem, pick up next week.